The John Age Project.
Trust no one. Trust no one. Trust no one.
I'm your host, John Age. Thank you so much for joining us today in the Anomic Age. We got a great show for you today. We got Dr. James Tracy coming up in a bit to talk about all things academia, his persecution, his trial case, the whole nine yards. We'll get into that in just a bit. But before we do, please check out anomicage.com. Please share that link with your friends, family, loved ones, and enemies. The information breakdown segment's kind of new to the page, and I feel a new one coming on. It's been about a week since I put a new one of those out, but I've been so busy with the regular show, haven't done one of those yet this week, so look for one forthcoming. You can also find all the information from our past guests, the video, the audio, all the links, contact info for me, all the social media links, and most importantly, because it's not free for me, but it is free for you, you can donate to paypal.me/anomicage and patreon.com/anomicage. Both of those links are linked up directly on the homepage. What did I mention it again? Oh, anomicage.com. That's it, right? So you can find all that much more. Also, you can subscribe to the newsletter. Download the iPhone and Android apps if you so desire. And you can just go to the podcast link direct from anomicage.com. So, after we've gotten that out of the way, please hold on to your hats and stick around for just a mere matter of seconds. We'll be joined by Dr. James Tracy on the other side. My pleasure to welcome Dr. James Tracy into the Anomicage today. James was a tenured associate professor of journalism and media studies at Florida Atlantic University for 14 years. FAU stripped Tracy of his tenure and terminated him in 2016 for failing to file paperwork disclosing his personal blogging. He has since filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against Florida Atlantic University that was tried in 2017. And is presently before the U.S. Court of Appeals. Tracy has published numerous research articles and book chapters on journalism, media history. He holds a doctoral degree from the University of Iowa and blogs at memoryholeblog.org. Thank you so much, Dr. Tracy, for being with us today. It's an honor.
Thanks, John. Thanks for inviting me. Happy to be here.
Well, I was really trying to figure out the best place to start, and I suppose we should get into your story because if folks haven't heard it, it's quite compelling and, dare I say it, insane. But also in the scope of doing that, I think it will serve to sort of focus on something else, which is, for me, just demystifying what I refer to as the cult of academia. I always say K-12 indoctrination, college, university, weaponization. But for a lot of people, I think when they hear certain fields, perhaps like academia or lawyers or the medical field, folks have this certain perception. I didn't really mean to lead it here, but largely based on what they perceive in the media, like their favorite sitcom that's based on lawyers or medicine or what have you. They really have that perception largely based on false perceptions. So in just going through sort of the trials and tribulations of what you went through at Florida Atlantic, I think it'll serve to sort of do both. It'll expose the cult of academia a little bit and get into your story.
Yeah, absolutely. What one sees in the news media is oftentimes very different from reality, right? Simply because of the fact that the news media are only able to focus on a story and give it 6,800 words in their defense, or maybe a minute and a half in an evening newscast. But until you've been an object of reportage, until you've been a subject of the story, you really don't know how frequently dishonest the news media can be. And I discovered that repeatedly. And I'm a professor of journalism and media studies. And that's what my training is in, specifically the historical, what have you, of the media. And and also media criticism. I've taught that and media political economy and ownership of the media and the impact that that has on what we see and read and hear. And all of these things, I think, culminated between 2013 and 2015, when I believe that the media, certain media outlets, had it in for me because of the fact that I had a professorial post, a post in academia, and I also had a personal blog where I was asking questions about what they were reporting on and the veracity of their reportage and their commentary and the honesty of it. And John, it's it has been in many ways gratifying to watch President Trump's presidency over the past 4 years, because a lot of what I experienced between 2013 and 2015 has been proven through the media's treatments of his presidency, and the just the duplicitous nature of the media alongside the Democratic Party. It's obvious that they're entirely partisan. And we had a partisan press in this country back in the 19th century. Now, most newspapers were aligned with either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. And perhaps we should go back to that, because that's essentially what it's like, more so than probably the past 120 years or so. And journalism sought to sell itself, if you will, to promote itself on this model of objectivity. And we're not going to take sides. The journalistic product is going to be objective. This was on a social scientific model, which I'm sure you could appreciate. Mm-hmm. And the schools of journalism that were established in the early 20th century were all established alongside the establishment of the social sciences, like psychology and economics and political science and sociology. All of these were coming into their own in the late 19th, early 20th century, alongside the creation and founding of journalism schools at, you know, U of Missouri and U of Northwestern, and of course Columbia, many of the other Big Ten schools. And there was this idea that journalism was going to be objective, and we're going to have the opinion sequestered onto the onto those, the opinion and op-ed pages and cartoons and things of the like. But now that's completely broken down. Nothing could be more obvious concerning that than what's taking place now with the Hunter Biden laptop, the laptop from Hellgate, if you will, and the fact that the media are completely turning a blind eye toward that. In the days before perhaps the most important presidential election in a very long time.
I was reading yesterday where it was over 40 big news media outlets, if you want to call them publications, but they're more than that just now, have this information on what's on the laptop. They have 40 plus news outlets have what's on the laptop, and the crickets are chirping.
And the FBI has had it for over a year, for about a year, and they've sat on it. And we know this now. The FBI really specializes more so in cover-ups than it does in investigations, right? And the higher, the greater the status of the individuals involved, the greater a chance there's going to be a cover-up. So the corruption is just rife. It's just throughout our institutions, and it's very concerning, and we're at a very pivotal, very important time, I think, in this country's history, and we've seen this over the past several months as well. The challenges with the COVID-19 and whatever one wishes to make of that, we could drill down on that too, perhaps, but also the quote-unquote protests, or if you wish to call them that, or rebellions in various major cities throughout our country. the campaigns to defund the police in so many municipalities as well. All of these things are very concerning, and it's interesting that they're all converging at roughly the same time in the lead up to the 2020 presidential election.
Yeah, it's so insane how much is going on at the same time. It's like this perfect storm of these confluence of events where you got the BLM, you got the Antifa, you got the continued deterioration of Biden even before the laptop scandal, and now you got the laptop scandal, the ever-looming Russia collusion all over everything. It's all Russia, I tell you. It's Russia. I mean, I jokingly, a few episodes back, I was joking because I used to say everything was racist because that was the hot term. No matter what it was, I would call it racist, and now I'm just going to say it's Russia. You know, if I get a flat tire, it's Russian collusion.
It's been Russian collusion since 2017.
Yeah.
This is something that California Representative Adam Schiff just came out with just a short while ago. That the Biden laptop scandal and all of that is attributable to Russians and Russian interference. And the FBI came out a few days ago saying that Iran's involved too. They're trying to subvert the electoral process. It's interesting that the Democratic Party, the communists, whatever you wish to call them, they typically accuse the other party of doing what they're guilty of. And they know, they're well aware of their own guilt, and they project it onto their opponents. This has been going on. Now it's apparent, increasingly apparent with these revelations concerning all of this info and the fact that Hunter Biden was globetrotting around the world, forging all of these different deals and selling access to the Obama presidency and to his father. This is glaringly apparent now that they were in fact guilty of Ukrainian collusion, perhaps Russian collusion. He did get $3.5 million from the spouse of the mayor of Moscow. Chinese as well, collusion with the Chinese Communist Party and corporations in China. So all of this stuff is going on, and yet they're pointing the finger at Trump. And there's an impeachment trial for a telephone call that Trump makes to Ukrainian president, saying maybe we ought to look into some of this stuff. Maybe there's some I see that there's some smoke here. Maybe there's some fire too. Mm-hmm. So it's really amazing. It's very interesting times, and it couldn't be a more apt time for good journalism. And some of the best journalism and commentary that's going on is it's not being created by professional journalists, professional news organizations, but rather by folks who take to YouTube or now BitChute and other channels that might not be as censored, and they're coming out with a real commentary. And the outlets that have billions or millions of dollars, huge budgets, are the ones that are just really producing the propaganda and the program.
It's really so bizarre. I sort of look at our whole society in this lens of Orwellian doublespeak now, kind of like you said. Whatever they tell you it is, it's always the inverse of that. I've heard that said about Pravda. If you want to know the truth of what Russia would say with Pravda, just think the inverse. And sadly, I think that's kind of where we are as a nation now. But to really connect dots back to the cult of academia, I would probably credit myself with being hugely naive before I kind of peered behind the curtain, because I used to think, oh, academia is this place where there's all this free speech and you exchange these ideas and you're supposed to follow this rigorous scientific method, and you can debate theories and test hypotheses. But little did I know, once you get in there, it's much the inverse. It is that tyrannical, fascistic thing that they always accuse everyone right of Mao of being. I think that would sort of surmise the groupthink of academia. If you step out of line with the lemmings and the sheep, then you're immediately ostracized and cast to the weeds.
If you think differently, if you have a different political perspective and sense those who are employed in the higher ed industry are primarily leftist, left of center, liberals, what have you, then if you have that mindset, you'll get along fine. But if you are critical of that mindset and you're more conservative, then you'll have potential problems. And when I entered academe in 1996, I went to graduate school at University of Arizona and for media studies, and then for my master's, and then in 1998, I went to University of Iowa to study journalism and news media more specifically. And, you know, that also involved intellectual history as well of the social sciences and their development in the 20th century and that type of thing. At the time I was, very much, I think, left of center, Marxist, atheistic, and I think that is something that is really expected of individuals, and that is one way that they will rise up in the ranks. You know, I attribute in part my hiring to my first and only tenure track position at FAU because I saw eye to eye with the individuals who were interviewing me. And in terms of politics, and I don't think that necessarily all of them were as left of center as I was, but they weren't conservative either. And so I was just fine, right? And it wasn't until, I guess, 6 or 8 years after I was hired that we had our first 2 children. And I think that had a big impact on me reevaluating what my priorities were and how I thought about the world. Re-examining what I've been taught too. And I began the blog in 2012, but all these things were kind of percolating in my mind anyway. But that was a way to kind of express them. And it was an extracurricular writing endeavor, if you will. None of it was, this was something that we could talk about that concerning my whole legal ordeal in attempting to get my position back. I think that the university sought to construe the blog as being academic, and it was not academic. But it was something that it was an outlet that I had to do some media criticism on the life. And I don't think it required any special training or anything either. There are a lot of good media critics out there on YouTube, or that have their blogs, that don't have a doctorate or, you know, even an undergraduate degree in media studies or anything of the like. I don't think it's necessarily necessary. I had the blog up for several months, and then the Sandy Hook school massacre took place. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even one to follow these types of things, true crime or anything of the like. And I recall my wife saying, the day of that, the evening of that event, it was December 14th, 2012. Did you hear about this terrible thing that took place in Connecticut? It was awful. And I hadn't heard anything about it, really. I mean, I had. I knew that it had taken place by listening to NPR or whatever the other news in the daytime. But that's the extent of it. And it wasn't until I actually started looking at the reportage more closely and asking questions and publishing those questions ultimately the news media picked up on this, because there were a few things that I posted that were picked up by other blogs and got a great deal of traction. And I think that as these things go, as we know now with, you know, the rise of cancel culture, there are certain professionals, opinion leaders like academics or journalists, bloggers that are held up as an example. We shouldn't think like this. We shouldn't have these types of questions. What we report, you should just accept without question. And that simply goes against the whole creed of academia, what we're taught in academia, I thought, whether you're on the left or the right doesn't matter. So that seems silly to me. But anyway, I was, my blog was, became, for a short period of time as these, you know, these news cycles go, it became a household word. And, I had CNN out in my driveway and everything in early in January of 2013. And it's nothing I asked for, really. But, I think that what it comes down to is they sought to intimidate me, to quiet me down, to silence me. And the blog and my speech on the blog, because they, you know, they didn't agree with it. I don't think it's CNN or the news media. They answer to higher authorities. And I think that it was the higher authorities speaking. If you don't keep it down, if you don't tone it down, we're going to get you fired. And that's ultimately what happened a few years later.
So you were getting that message from the news media or just folks on the blog or what? I mean, well, I'm guessing it probably wasn't that blatant, but that sort of subtle innuendo that if you don't tone this content down, we're going to try to get you out of here?
Well, certainly. Yeah, there was a great deal of pressure by the news media, the regional and local news media, the Palm Beach Post to a lesser degree, but they really didn't chime in until 2015 or so, and they had changed their ownership. But it was primarily the South Florida Sun Sentinel, which is owned by the Tribune Company, which also owns the Hartford Courant up in Connecticut. And the Hartford Courant was one of the main news organs that was reporting on the Sandy Hook massacre. And so I think that there's a tie-in there. Can't necessarily put my finger on, but the South Florida Sun Sentinel and the broadcast media, the local broadcast media here as well, I think that they were involved more or less in seeking to put pressure on the university to fire me or to discipline me or what have you. This was in 2013. And then after this also recurred with the Boston Marathon bomb, because there were a number of blog posts that I published concerning that. That was just 5 months after the Sandy Hook school massacre event. And so the media came down hard on that too, in terms of reportage, because I don't, you know, I don't do this for attention. It's simply to, and seldom does this commentary rise above the alternative news media. I did not necessarily expect for it to, and yet it did. And the story was, here's this nutty professor, and he's asking these questions he shouldn't ask, and that's another thing that they hit you over the head with. You're a conspiracy theorist, right? And that's that is a term that was developed by the intelligence community to keep people quiet. Professionals, salaried opinion leaders, like academics and journalists.
Yeah, absolutely. I want people to process how completely antithetical to science and academia this is. You're basically just asking a question. You're posing a hypothesis.
Yeah.
And you're getting shut down. You're getting CNN and the like showing up on your lawn, and you're getting these folks pressuring. And you use the – I'm paraphrasing it. I'm not sure if this is the exact term you said – the academic industry, because that's exactly what it is. I mean, make no mistake about it, this is a business. So when you send your sons and daughters off to college, it's a business, folks. It is an absolute business, like McDonald's and Federal Express. So, but back to the point there, you're getting all kinds of flack from just asking a question here.
I had a handful of colleagues who, you know, considered also friends who did come to me and speak in confidence, saying, "This is crazy. This is you're supposed to be critiquing the media. I mean, what difference does it make?
That is kind of what you do.
It's a big deal, yeah." And I think that they had to be careful themselves, because they don't want to be painted with the same brush. So there's this whole chilling effect that takes place, and that was really on display when I was terminated too, because everyone stepped aside. And the whole story and the note, this was more complex. I don't know if we have the time to go into it, but Sure. It's the idea of, oh, he's this conspiracy theorist, and now he's being accused of criminal harassment. And so this is, you know, this goes into the, which was not true. Yet this, and the media were well aware that that was not true. Looked at, if they would be honest about it, they would have to report it as such. They chose to report on it from the vantage point of my accusers. And, this as well put pressure on the university to terminate me, which is what they ultimately did. And I think, I don't know if they were walking marching orders or whatever the case may be, but, they didn't care what they did. They just sought to get rid of me, and they would justify it later. And that's ultimately what they did. And we know that now through the ton of documents that we got through discovery, and as well as through testimony on record from the university officials. So it's just shoot first, ask questions later. So and now that's becoming more and more common. I was fired on a pretext, but I didn't fill out paperwork for my blog. Which is, there are a lot of faculty members that have blogs. A lot of faculty have Facebook. A lot of faculty have Twitter. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got a lot of Facebook friends who are academics. And granted, we don't post stuff on each other's wall anymore because most of them are, you know, Marxist communists.
Exactly.
But I see the stuff that they're posting about, you know, the Trump administration and Donald Trump, and he's bad, and he's this, and he's, you know, and they're doing this under the rubric of their professional title, you know, professor at FAU, professor at Rutgers, whatever the case may be,
mm-hmm.
and they're very stridently expressing their political views, and same on Twitter. So, you know, it's all social media, and they are not filling out the equivalent paperwork to have those social media accounts. And yet there's an exception for me. And that's really the essence of the lawsuit. You made an exception for Dr. Tracy because you did not agree with his views. And his views were, you know, causing your public relations department some strife. That's what it came down to. So
it sounds like that favorite double standard again. I mean, right out of Animal Farm, some animals are equal. I mean, excuse me, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. Sounds like what we got going on as usual.
Yes, and that's, as I'm sure you're aware from experience, that's what takes place in academia. And I'm sure that takes place in newsrooms as well. There's research done on this, that through a kind of socialization process, you learn what to say, what not to say, what is going to actually float as far as being printed, maybe saliently on the front page, with your name in the byline, and what is not going to be printed, what's sacred cow. And I think that that's the same case with academia, perhaps even more so, as far as what questions can be asked, what types of things can be researched, because there was a whole harassment campaign that took place concerning me, even prior to my firing. We were, discussing briefly in the pre-interview about gang stalking, and there were various forms of gang stalking that were taking place with me. I had a colleague who I'm fairly certain who it was, but that's regardless. It's not relevant now. I had a letter that was written by three colleagues in my college telling me to resign, and the letter was copied and distributed to everyone in my department and put in their department mailboxes. And at the same time, it was being published by both newspapers, both regional newspapers. But that's obviously, that's a real form of harassment.
Absolutely.
And that's something that was, it actually was brought up, what have you, in the depositions, in the, the litigation leading up to trial. As well as other things such as giving me a different teaching load, not any greater of a teaching load, but having me teach other classes at times of the day which conflicted with my childcare schedule, and just these various death of a thousand cuts, these various types of ways of letting you know that we don't agree with what you're doing and what you're saying, and you better tone it down. So all of this was being overseen, I think, quite carefully by the upper level administration and by their lead attorneys. So it's very unfortunate that we don't have academic freedom in this country. And I think that if taxpayers recognized what was being done with their money, it's public universities, private ones as well, that receive federal money.
That's right.
I think they will be very, very concerned about how it's being distributed and how it's being spent to, in many cases, really ideologically indoctrinate their children. Look at what's going on in our streets. Look at what's going on in Seattle and Portland. We have a whole generation. This has been going on for quite some time, as you know, as far as the kind of indoctrination. But we have a segment of the younger population now that believe that they're persecuted and oppressed, and they've got to go out and now, you know, hit someone over the head because of it, bust up shop windows and so forth. And prevent someone from speaking that they don't agree with. So that's where it's led. And when I was in graduate school, we were studying a lot of this social theory that was really kind of advocating this whole cult of victimhood. I said to myself, no way are we ever really going to see this manifest itself to such a degree. But we now see that. And I don't think it's entirely organic either. I think that there's obviously George Soros, so we can't, even the former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives can't bring him up in an interview.
I think saw that on Fox. Yeah, you can't say the S word.
Right, because of his credibility. Now they especially have to silence him because I think that he has a great deal of, pulls a good deal of weight. In the punditocracy, if you will. But there's a lot of money involved in fueling this discontent. And I think some of it is organic and some of it is coming from the grassroots, but a lot of it, and particularly the violence and so forth, is not, I don't believe.
Yeah, that's what's so disheartening and what a lot of people don't grasp. Is that this has definitely been a multi-generational thing. I mean, I've touched on this many times, where their goal has been to move that Overton window of what's accepted for at least probably 50 years plus now. Well, I'm way on the plus side of that. I'm just going conservatively 50 years. And we're seeing the proverbial chickens coming home to roost, like those people you see out there burning the cities down and shooting people and the like. They're the byproducts of that. That's what they got fed in the K-12 and in the college university. And unfortunately, yes. To your point, I mean, that's what you're seeing teaching your sons and daughters at university. I mean, a lot of these professors have been caught all over the media in on this. They're the people behind some of this Antifa stuff. They're the folks out here.
They're teachers. They're teachers. A number of them have been apprehended and they've been found out to be public school teachers. Or you know, college educators as well, and you know, those of us who have been in academia understand what the kind of political climate is, and what the sort of impetus to sort of follow and kind of regurgitate, if you will, is what views are accepted and what are not.
I didn't really know how much you wanted to get into this, but I thought I'd go back to it a little bit because that gang stalking thing is a real thing. And a lot of people tend to think, oh, you know, it's just a sort of peer pressure thing. It's nothing to worry about. It's not real. It's a conspiracy. I mean, you went through quite a bit. I think you mentioned something about a breaking in to your home and things being stolen. Again, if you don't want to get into it, that's fine. I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Well, this was in the this was after my termination, just about 1 year after my termination, when we introduced we filed the complaint in April of 2016. So it was just 4 months after my after my termination, 4 to 5 months after that. And ultimately, this was, you know, there was a stay on discovery, of course, which is really just pro forma by the defendant FAU and the individual defendants, number of university administrators, and at the time also the faculty union. The faculty union was included as a defendant in the lawsuit, in particular officers of the union. And so the case was allowed to go forward in December of 2016. The judge ruled that the case could move forward to discovery. And that was, I believe, on the 15th of December of 2016. And 1 week later, our house was burglarized. And my computer was taken, and there was a laptop that was taken. And interestingly, because my wife is also an employee at FAU, and she had an FAU laptop here at our residence that was like almost brand new. It's like a $900 laptop. And that was not taken, which is interesting. I don't know exactly why that is. Maybe these were very sloppy burglars, but it seems as if they knew what they wanted. They even took my microphone. I had another microphone similar to this. I think these are great mics, these MXLs. And that was taken as well in my old soundboard that I made podcasts with. So it seems as if it was kind of a statement, you know, be quiet. But it was also a way to obtain files, things that we had gotten in the lead up to filing the complaint, the initial complaint. And we had to rewrite the complaint. Our legal team had to rewrite the complaint, and that was done. And I think that was filed, and we were only given like a 10-day window. It was filed at the end of December of 2016. And then so the litigation, which is, I mean, going through this whole process is really, it's really something. I mean, in many ways, it's very, it's a learning process. It's very eye-opening. And that transpired throughout 2017, and then we had the trial in November, December of 2017. And we were displeased because 1 month before trial, in fact, it was the 3-year anniversary coming up in a couple of days. On October 31st, the judge filed her ruling that threw out about 4/5 of our case. Much of the complaint, the civil rights dimension of it, freedom of speech, were thrown out the window by her, as well as a lot of our discovery. We could not use. We were admonished for using in court, and so that was really disheartening. So we had to go into court. We had to go into trial with one and a half arms tied behind our back. There were a lot of things that we couldn't bring up. The defense, for example, would not allow us to bring up the fact that there were civil rights organizations, including the Fairness. The Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, and the American Association of University Professors that wrote letters in my defense back in 2013 when the university initially came down on me. There were various portions of testimony and depositions that could not be included. We had one of my former colleagues who I knew quite well break down in tears during a deposition because of what he knew and the fact that he would not have tenure. And our attorney, lead attorney, asked him, "Are you fearful of FAU and of retribution?" He said, "Yes, yes." And you had the defendant's attorneys seeking to walk him back on what he had said and the information that he knew. And so that was called by the judge. This person does not, they're not certain of their testimony. They're not sure what they're saying. Well, of course they do. It was highlighted. It was emphasized through his emotion and being torn in terms of allegiances to a friend, myself, and his profession and colleagues at the university. So those were just, I mean, there's so much. Such a multitude of experiences and things that took place during the litigation process that were, you know, were very, really something, things obviously I'll never forget. And, all because of, I had a controversial blog. I, was a professor with views that were not, you know, and what's important here as well is much of this is ideological, because if I had a blog where I was, say, writing a column for The Nation magazine or Mother Jones, or, you know, if I was arguing for pro-choice or, you know, anti-Second Amendment, any number of issues on the left.
No, you'd have been fine.
People would have, you know, been cheering me on. But the fact that I was questioning these really dubious events that were being reported as wholly factual by the commercial news media, well, that's cause for concern. So.
And I have to wonder how much of this repercussive action was just because you were getting too close to the truth. I mean, we don't even have to get into the whole Sandy Hook debacle. But for my money, I mean, if you would have been just questioning something more mundane, I don't know if you'd have gotten this much flack. And to go back to the original question, I have to completely agree that they were probably breaking into your house and stealing your stuff as an element to silence you, and a bit of a psyop as well, just letting you know, hey, we can get this close to you. I mean, I think they could have easily broken into your office or your car, but they wanted to get that extra personal where you actually live and take stuff that could have relevance to the case or could have relevance to you continuing to do what you do.
Yeah, I think so too. Back in 2013, it was interesting that some of the phone calls as well, and emails, but especially there were a few phone calls in particular, suggesting that, you know, you're pretty close to the bone here. You're pretty close to the truth. And, somebody actually, you know, people who were in, prominent positions saying, you know, this is exactly what took place. And, the fact that you're getting so much pushback for it is, confirmation of that. But there were also some veiled threats too, by parties I'd never come in contact with before, just called me out of the blue. And then just, you don't know if these people, other people that are contacting you are, if they are sincere or if they just kind of have a screw loose upstairs, you know. That all of that is cause for concern. So.
Certainly is. I don't want to get into past guests too much, but it's either very coincidental or certainly providential this week. I've spoken with yourself. I spoke with investigative reporter Celia Farber. Excuse me, I was blanking her name there for a moment. Celia Farber. And then yesterday, John Massaria, a documentary filmmaker that delves into a lot of these same things. And here today with you, and all three were telling me very similar stories about encounters, veiled threats, stuff along these same lines, where they will send you a message pretty quick when you get too close to the truth that will let you know, hey, maybe I shouldn't go down this road. Maybe I shouldn't delve as deeply into this topic or that topic. And I can't say it's coincidental.
Right. Yeah. There's, the false notion that we live in a society that, is based on law and order, and that the law enforcement will, and our court system will, keep things on an even keel. But, is that the case? We've seen over the past several years with the incumbent in the president's, in the White House, there's a tremendous amount of corruption, at the federal level as well as at the state level. So, and perhaps we resemble more so the countries that we have looked to as being models of tyranny, you know, like China and Russia and so forth, and Axis powers in World War II. And, we've become increasingly like that, I'm afraid. There's just a decay of public institutions. And that's been underway for several decades, but it's gotten progressively worse. I think there's a relationship between the ownership of the media and the fact that this has been allowed to proceed and to kind of snowball over the past few decades. Whereas you had more multiple stakeholders, you know, dozens of stakeholders as far as owning various media. And now that's down to a handful. And ironically, well, you do have, there are a lot of, you know, independent websites and things like that. But as far as actually being able to produce, independent reportage and research, we have the internet, but ironically, there are arguably fewer avenues, and you have, entities that control so much of the U.S. attention span, and they're more powerful than ever, and they're owned by fewer and fewer corporations.
Yeah, it seems kind of silly, the amount of gaslighting that's going on. Like, for example, with the laptop now, it's never really mentioned in the mainstream media, and if it is, it's like, oh, that's not real. That's just collusion. That's just propaganda. I mean, we can go back to the church committee hearings where they first really unveiled the Operation Mockingbird, where they've infiltrated all forms of mass communication, basically. But I mean, that was well over almost 45 years ago. And here we are in 2020, and people still don't seem to grasp that that's by multiple going on right about now. I mean, we've got that going on now, not with just newspaper and your ABC, NBC news, but it's going on with blogs, with websites, with social media, with every avenue. And that sort of cognitive dissonance still doesn't seem to register with the average person. I mean, you can speak to that because I don't even know this, but when you were talking about your whole website got taken down by WordPress, I mean, that's pretty crazy.
Well, now they're being taken down left and right. Just a couple of weeks ago, there were several YouTube channels by the likes of SGT Report and others that were just summarily, eliminated. And fortunately, some of these producers have actually gotten an attorney, and they've raised over $1 million, and they're going to court. And the court date, I think, is November 2nd, and the public can view this on Zoom. There's statement announcing the hearing, court statement announcing the hearing is available on memoryholeblog.org and elsewhere. But one of the kind of canaries in the coal mine, I guess, was my website and a number of others that were just taken down from WordPress.com, eliminated. Mine was, I think, one of the first, and I had gone on to another website provider, blog provider, Bluehost for a short period of time, and I wanted to move back to WordPress.com, and they would not allow me to come back. So I was, the blog was homeless briefly, and I had to very quickly find someone else that would host the blog. And someone I knew from the alternative media recommended an individual, and this individual was unfortunately not very stable or reliable and put the blog on a malicious server. And I was trying to get the blog back because I realized that the people who are going to it now might be getting viruses, if they were at the very least getting warnings. And I don't know if someone got to this individual and paid him off to sabotage the website, but for several months it was up on this website that was people didn't trust, or on the server, I should say, that people did not trust. And so, you know, it's just been, we finally did get it back in operation. It does not have the degree of traffic that it once did, especially on WordPress.com, where it was, you could more easily share posts and the like than you can now. And I actually have another website or blog on WordPress.com called James F. Tracy. WordPress.com, and that was, I noticed months ago, that was taken down as well, and was not given any sort of prior notice or anything of the like. No courtesy extended in that regard. In fact, when memoryholeblog.com was, when WordPress.com chose not to take it back, I asked for an explanation, and the representative flat out said, no, we're not giving an explanation. We're not required to, we're not going to give you one. So I think that there was, that it was opportune for our opposing parties in the lawsuit to not have my blog up and running during litigation, because one could go there for regular reports on what was taking place, and do so, and you know, go beyond the what the news media was reporting, because their reportage of the trial was just a travesty. It's very unfortunate. And the Palm Beach Post actually, I think, was a much more honest newspaper several years ago than they are now. I'm not just saying that for myself or concerning the reportage of my trial and my ordeal, but other sorts of controversies and events too. So they offer very little alternative. And the Sun Sentinel is bad as well. And the Sun Sentinel is the one that started this whole controversy by reporting on my blog back in early 2013.
That's what's so insane, that a lot of people don't seem to grasp how slippery this slope is. I mean, this is a playbook out of every tyrannical totalitarian regime ever. We've got to control the narrative, whether that means killing journalists, whether that means stifling the newspaper, burning the books, what have you. I mean, that's the key. So if they can take away your ability to speak to anybody by taking away your site, then they've essentially cut your story off, and they can just keep on going with whatever story, whether it's James Tracy believes in flying leprechauns, then the whole world's going to think flying leprechauns is it.
Yeah. Right. That's unfortunately what transpired. And you have a very limited ability to contest what they are saying if they have established a particular narrative. I was given a gag order when I was being terminated, that I could not speak to the media. They did not want me speaking to the media. And because I think that they wanted to get me out the door before I could actually say anything.
Mm-hmm.
About the importance of the case. Cases did not just involve James Tracy, but it involved more so academic freedom and free speech. And now we see what's taking place. A lot of universities just fearlessly go ahead and fire faculty for saying the slightest thing. There was this female academic, I believe, at University of Massachusetts, who was an administrator in the College of Nursing, and she sent an email not only to Black Lives Matter, all lives matter. And that was controversial enough to get her fired. Now, think of the sort of, the climate that we're living in. If that's the case, one could get fired for probably a heck of a lot less. You now have to be very careful about what you say in emails. It's like being in East Germany, 1960 or something.
It really is. It's very reminiscent of Germany or Mao or the gulags in Russia. It's all the same sort of sick stuff. I mean, I won't give names here, but the irony is I'm friends with another person in media studies, not where you are, totally different state, different university, a whole nine yards. But, I mean, a few years back, he was having similar incidences going on with his department and similar trying to get him out as well. Which he just said, screw this, and picked up shop and moved to a different state, different university, whole nine yards, because he didn't want to have to go through probably something similar to you, because it was going along those same lines with the different faculty and the administration and everything. And I was not really surprised, but I suppose a bit surprised when I really hear more and more of these stories. I know Dr. Daryl Hamamoto, I believe, in California faced similar incidences as you, and and you mentioned the other female faculty member a moment ago. I mean, it just is really ubiquitous. It's way more common than people think. It isn't an isolated thing. I think if anything, there's a lot more folks out there that are probably like-minded, but they're afraid to stick their head out because they don't want to get whacked.
Yeah, I think so too. They're just hanging low. And Professor Hamamoto, his career path followed a similar trajectory as mine, in that I think that he went into the academy as being quite, you know, left of center. Of course, he had to more or less to fit in. And then he began looking at things somewhat differently and more critically towards the end of his career. And that was a multi-year program to get him out of UC Davis. Went on and all sorts of different types of harassment in order to get him to retire. I think he was closer to retirement than I was. And I believe that the timings of our being pulled from the classroom, now that I think of it, because we were in touch at the time, was around late 2015, within the course of like a week or so. I think that he was given an order, that there was some sort of decision from the UC Davis administration, or maybe even higher up, that he was not going to be returning to the classroom in 2016. So it's interesting that those events almost coincided. So, but now there is a web page that the National Association of Scholars has put together, documenting all of the cases involving cancel culture and cases leading up to that. And I think that it goes back to the 1970s. But the cases involving dismissal of a faculty member were few and far between, 50 years ago. And now it's almost every week or more where there's someone who's being let go because they said one thing or another that rubbed people the wrong way. I think that what we have here, and I'm actually working on a video examining this at present, is we can kind of have a deification of identity, where people, in order to have a place at the table, they need to have a certain type of identity, a certain oppression that they can identify with, be it LGBTQ or race or what have you. And then they can ascribe to whatever that ideology, that worldview is, and get agitated about whatever it might be that someone says or does, or, you know, speaker coming to campus, and that way they feel involved and they feel justified. They have worth, based upon their particular, how they feel that they're being persecuted. And, you know, there was actually, I think, a time when this was more valid, say the civil rights movement, or, you know, there was some degree of justification for this and protest and the like. But now, I think that the rationales are much less substantive than they once were.
It's really bizarre, and I've mentioned this several times in the past as well. I'm sure people are tired of hearing it, but the Frankfurt School and this notion of relativity and critical theory, that's the pet theory seemingly of all social sciences. It didn't really occur to me until I was looking back in retrospect how much of every aspect of these different fields has to do with that silly critical theory. It's all based on your sex, your race, your gender, your immigrants, your whatever. It's whatever little pet field you want to get pigeonholed into, but you could focus on just that. That can be your whole career. It could be critical race theory, critical gender theory, and so forth.
Yeah, I think that the Frankfurt School got the ball rolling with the Dialectic of Enlightenment, and subsequent to that, just a few years later, the Authoritarian Personality was published. And it was a series that was published called Studies in Prejudice, and it was funded by the American Jewish Committee. It's a major political lobbying organization for the Jewish community and for Israel. And I always found that interesting because since that is such a foundational work for what is going on in the academy today, a whole lot of, the ideas that began percolating in the 1950s, 1960s, and kind of manifesting themselves in the civil rights movement, the gender, equality movement, the anti-war movement. But that all began with the Frankfurt School, arguably. And these guys are all emigres, Jewish emigres from Germany, from Europe.
That's right.
30s, and were kicked out of there with the rise of Hitler. So I was always taken aback as to why we were not assigned that work, the authoritarian personality. And, the dozens of graduate seminars that I took and all of the various books and articles that we've read, that was never touched upon. And I'm wondering as to whether or not it might have been, we get in our hands, we see that it's funded by a political group. It's in a series of books funded by a political group. Well, what does that suggest about the validity of the scholarship? And we now know that there were a lot of compromises in the work to make it to make the end product look as if it did, and it was the beginning of, I think, the kind of denigration of the middle class, of European Americans. Christianity, all of these things were looked upon as being psychopathological. And so you have a number of scholars, majority of whom were Jewish, who took up this theme in subsequent years, subsequent decades, and carried it further. And so I think that is one of the important underlying elements of this whole notion of white supremacy that we hear so much about today. I think it's much more, ballyhooed than actually exists. Another individual that was involved in this was the historian Richard Hofstadter. And he developed the whole idea of the paranoid style of American politics. Jewish historian from Harvard. And if you look at some of the contemporary works on conspiracies and conspiracy theory, many of them point to Hofstadter as being foundational as well in the whole notion. And this is something that extended obviously far beyond academia, the whole idea of the paranoid style of American politics. Where was it? Well, it's in the far right, conservatives. As Obama said, it's those clinging to their guns and their Bibles. Now, this stereotype has really, got roots now very deeply in the American psyche. So when you say something like white supremacy, people jump. Oh yeah, that's a real problem.
And it was Obama that was also saying, don't listen to those outrageous conspiracy theories.
Well, that was George W.
Oh, was it him too?
Excuse me. Yeah, George Bush.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I'm mistaken. You're correct. Yep.
Those outrageous conspiracy theories. Whose dad was in the CIA, and the CIA certainly had a role in developing that term. Mm-hmm. So that's still very effective. They're conspiracy theorists. These people are crazy. I mean, they're out in the boondocks, and they don't they're motivated by things like religion and God. Oh. No, it's just awful. And so you have these generally really urban intellectuals, who have the institutional kind of burnish, given that they're at major universities, and they really look down their nose at this whole notion. And I think that, Frankfurt School and Hofstadter, Daniel Bell, there are... number of intellectuals, of primarily Jewish intellectuals, who were also generally dominated the field of communication, research, psychological warfare research post-World War II, and were very instrumental in that. And that goes back all the way to Paul Lazarsfeld, who's a foundational member of the development of mass communication research in the United States. That was another Jewish immigrant, European Jewish immigrant. So, they were very, very influential in the formation of media studies, but more so in the, how we have come to recognize, understand, perhaps misunderstand, the American psyche and the political elements of that and predilections of that.
Yeah, I mean, all those things really do culminate into shaping people the way they are. I always go back to that silly old saying, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I think when they get those students out of that academic industry, I mean, they've been force-fed that critical theory and that victim, victim, victim for so long, then they kind of have to assume that role, whether it's I'm a victim because I'm a woman, I'm a immigrant, I'm black, I'm Hispanic, whatever the case may be, you've got to assume that victimhood so you can get the brass ring, which is really just so disheartening. But it's not surprising when I see what they're getting taught and coming out doing. It's kind of like, well.
But unfortunately, then you're spending a lot of time on ruminating on how am I being oppressed today, rather than maybe going out and forging, finding – establishing a business or doing something else that might somehow benefit you. Somehow I've been so oppressed in some sort of way, shape, or form. That's not to say that those things do not exist, and I think that there is such a thing as systemic racism. But how is that going to be resolved by dwelling on the various elements of our language?
Yeah, and they're using all those forms that you study and mention to shape this perception. They're using the celebrities. I mean, that's straight out of the Edward Bernays playbook. We're using celebrities to shape the minds and the movies and the television shows and now Netflix and everything else. So you're really getting that creation of a narrative where I've jokingly said in the past, I mean, people talk as if we're coming out of a scene out of Birth of a Nation where Klan members are on horseback just riding through the countryside, stringing people up in 2020, when that's the furthest thing from reality. But if you would look at the mainstream news, the mainstream sports stars, the celebrities, they're all sort of promulgating that same sort of narrative and victimhood to unwitting subjects, so to speak.
Yeah, well, with Black Lives Matter, that's a front. It's a slogan, because if you look at their platform, it's the Communist Party. It's a element of the U.S. Communist Party. They're talking about destruction of the family and the blending of genders and all of these various types of things. And I believe that, it's much more than meets the eye. However, if you're just, looking at a ball game or something, it's great that the NBA is endorsing Black Lives Matter. They're taking a knee, whatever. That's really not what's going on. And one has to go no further than their own website. So. And I think, unfortunately, that there's, in terms of our history, we are limited in terms of what we actually know about previous communist revolutions, why aren't we taught that? We're taught about the rise of Nazi Germany. Okay, very good. But how about the rise of communism in the Soviet Union, or China, or a number of other countries? If that's something that was emphasized more so in high school history class, clues to what's going on today. What's defund the police really all about? Is it really all about, fighting systemic racism? Or does it have to do with setting up the equivalent of, the Cheka, which is the secret police of of the Communist Party back in between 1917 and 1922 in the Soviet Union. That's one of the reasons that a very small percentage of the country itself was able to overthrow the government. Huge country. So these things are not, they're not even touched upon in high school or anything like that. And that's very unfortunate because that puts us in an increasingly politically precarious situation. We don't know the history and the experience of other countries that have fallen to communism. How do we know when and to what degree we may be falling into it ourselves?
That's the truth. I mean, I couldn't agree more. You get history is pretty much Hitler, but they're leaving out a lot of these other major players. And I can't help but wonder if it's not because we have such intrinsic ties to those people getting into power. If you look at Joe Stalin, I mean, he was Time Magazine Man of the Year, I think about three different times. And of course, Chairman Mao, we ushered him into power in China. And this, you could draw the same sort of connections between Vietnam War and the Opium Triangle and Pol Pot. And I mean, I feel like if they started really delving into that history, people would start going, hey, wait a minute. Did we put these people in power? Huh.
And why aren't academic historians delving into it as well?
Yeah.
You have someone like Anthony Sutton, you know, who had a position, I think, at Cal State and the Hoover Institution at Stanford. And that was jeopardized because he was delving into things and finding things out that really were not supposed to be in our history books. And a whole wealth of them, of what is taught as just commonsensical knowledge today, there's really much, much more to it than meets the eye. And the things that are taken for granted, even by history scholars with PhDs and what have you, there's a whole, you know, set of histories and the like that we don't know anything about and that should be emphasized much more so than they actually are in both both high school as well as university. Instead, we're spending time on gender studies and, you know, there are a lot of things that people are earning tenure with that I'm not sure really in the larger scheme of things how helpful, how useful they actually are. That's my view. I can say these sorts of things now because I'm not employed at the university.
That's the truth. I've thought and said the same things as well regarding the academic industry. I mean, what are you doing with this women's study degree again? Like, what are you going to do with that? I don't know. And the same could be said for a whole lot of other degrees. I'm not just picking on that one, but.
Right. Of course, you know, if I somehow am in the future in some way, shape, or form able to go back and teach at the university, this is one of the tapes that people are going to bring up, that other faculty are going to bring up in the next struggle session, right?
That's true.
Before you go to class, what were you saying here? You know,
great.
Beating you over the head and whatever. But you know it as well as I. And I've been removed from it for 5 years now.
Well, I realize this is a huge question to probably tackle, but as parents, I mean, what can people do to sort of save their children? I mean, I know that's probably a little bit dramatic for a lot of folks, but I don't think I'm too far off from all this insanity. At a certain point, I feel like just check out from the whole thing, but you still have to be a member of society to a degree, and you don't want your kids in some sort of bizarre Amish monastery or something probably either, so I don't know.
Well, the schools, the public schools leave much to be desired, and I'm not sure how much better the private schools are that one would, you know, pay $20,000 a year per student to be able to attend. How much more of an improvement are they? I think probably the best solution is homeschooling. And at the same time, I've got five children, and three of them are in school now. One of them goes to a public school, and two of them go to a charter school that we like to believe is somewhat better. It's a smaller environment, and you know, there's, I think, more of a sense of community there. But probably the number one thing you could do is to homeschool, or at least homeschool part of the time. But in addition, I think that young people, your children, when they're in your household, in your environment, they have your influences, and they get, I think, quite a bit simply from parentage. But you can control less if you send them to school. I mean, I don't know, my daughters are, let's see, 9, 11, and 14. And I don't know where they got this anti-Trump sentiment because they don't watch the news. They would certainly get it from there. I think that it has to do with, in part, what they encounter at school, not only perhaps via their teachers, but through through their peers, right? There's just this, aversion to, oh, well, I don't like him because he doesn't like the immigrants, or I don't like him because there's just these kind of knee-jerk responses or kind of rationales for why they dislike the present presidential incumbent. And it doesn't matter who he is, but why is there such, you know, aversion to him? Because I think that in part they absorb that at the school. And so I think parentage and the households can contribute to that. We can contribute to them becoming truly critical thinkers by questioning them. Well, why is it that you think that? You know, what evidence do you have that our immigration policy is the way that it is? Simply through pronouncements and sound bites, or is there something more to it? You know, since I left academe, I rejoined the Catholic Church. And I think that worship as well is an important element of the domestic realm. And I've done that in part because I want for my children to have a moral compass to be able to tell what's right and wrong, because they're not going to be able to understand that really, I believe, from a secular perspective. And that couldn't be more so the case today than it is. So, you know, I think that's important too, and that's, you know, an important part of mirroring. That's my personal choice, but I think that it's something that I wish I actually did sooner, because some children arguably need it more than others.
Yeah.
Simply on their character, their disposition, their kind of their inclinations, their needs. You know, emotionally and what have you, we know that there's a difference in terms of temperament with regard to our daughters. Our sons are, you know, one is 5 and one is 2. They're still growing. But the daughters are, you know, one is becoming, you know, in the brink of becoming a young adult. I think that kind of, that sort of the religious element is important. That's my personal belief. And that's something, another thing I would probably get hit over the head with too, if I were in academia, certainly discussing it or anything of the like, because we are all supposed to be, good secular citizens, and these sorts of things should not actually be discussed, because they, well, going back to the Frankfurt School to a certain degree, they suggest pure rationality.
Yeah, one of those primary tenets of the communist manifesto, you got to do away with religion.
And have a central bank and do away with the family and all of these things that our country is, I think, very much immersed in today. So.
Sadly, definitely sadly. Well, before we go, I sort of got to come back to the front here and say, how are things going today with your court case or just in general? I mean, I know it's been several years and a battle. Litigiously, I don't think most folks could really understand, but how is all that going today?
Well, we had the last we actually heard from the court was in September of 2019, when we went, when I say we, the legal team and myself, and actually took my daughters as well, we went to the oral argument. The court wanted to hear oral argument in the case. And so that was in Atlanta for the home of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. And since we are the appellants, the briefs were already filed. So usually if there's some disagreement or concern among the panel of judges, which is three judges, they ask for oral hearing, oral argument. And so that's, you know, that's just an hour. It's a kind of a big trip for just an hour oral argument. But they typically have it down here in Miami, but they, for some reason or another, schedule it up in Atlanta. So we don't know. We haven't heard anything. You know, it's been 14 months. And we hope to have a ruling one way or another. Most likely they would render it back to the district court here. And there would be another trial or something along those lines. But, it's, you know, it's been a haul. It's been, you know, it'll be 5 years, in December since, I've been without employment. And, it's a learning process, obviously. It's unfortunate that, the whole thing really ever took place. But, you know, we are happy. I think that the Court of Appeals did opt to at least, have oral argument. They only have oral argument in a small number of the cases. And, so we're hopeful. Hopeful as we can be, and with some degree of caution. But we believe that we were not treated well at all at the district court level, and that it was it was very partial to FAU to the university. And then with the faculty union, there was a settlement, and so they were out of the picture by the time the case went to trial. Unfortunately, this past February, our lead appellate attorney, Rick Overman, passed away. He was in his late 60s, so he was, you know, pretty young. But he got our case to almost to the finish line, you know. And so, you know, perhaps we'll have a positive verdict, and we'll think of him, because he, now, he took this case on in part because he was passionate about it, because he's a First Amendment attorney of some renown as well. So, I mean, his briefs are just really something, breathtaking. He's just a very good he's a very good attorney. And so we were fortunate to have he and the law firm of Carlton Fields come on board to help us with the appellate help us at trial, and as well as at the appeal. So that's where we stand.
So I guess best case scenario, you would get some sort of reinstatement?
That is what we are asking for. Yes.
Yeah.
That's what we're hoping for. And there have been, you know, there have been opportunities to, obviously there are settlement conferences along the way, both before you go to trial and before, going to the, through the appeals process. And those were not successful. So, what really more so than my situation, which is, I've come to accept it. There are blessings and lesser things, I guess, less desirable things when it comes to, you know, to being involved in something like this. But, much more so, and one of the major upshots of the case does not have to do with me as much so as it has to do with all faculty in Florida and throughout the country. And that is whether or not your university employer or public employer more broadly can use a pretext, can use a policy concerning your outside activities to fire you. And that's what FAU did. And that's what's at stake here. And I believe that, that FAU in the state of Florida would like to have that tool in their toolbox, for any other, you know, restive faculty member, or a public employee who, has a blog or who says something controversial on Twitter or on Facebook or something. They can use this. Okay. Did you fill this out? Did you fill out this outside activities employment form? Because that's really what it's all about. You know quite well being in there is that if you can't hold a full-time position and also go over and teach at Chapel Hill or Duke or something like that, you have to let the employer know.
The conflict of interest paperwork and all that jazz.
Right. Yes. And that's what this is about. They used that policy to fire me because they said my blog was employment, in essence. That's that's really how ridiculous this case is.
So you got to give up your First Amendment once you take a teaching position, apparently. Well, and it creates that chilling effect, like you mentioned earlier. And I think it transcends the faculty staff. I think that chilling effect is definitely seen among the students as well, because students know if they're going in right of mouth to a university and they get the professor X, Y, or Z that's not going to tolerate that, they basically have to camouflage any of their religious beliefs or any of their political beliefs to yes. get that pass or to get that good graces, or what I'm hearing was recommendation letters. I'm not going to get a recommendation letter if I
on the occasion that you have a conservative professor or a liberal, you know, nine times out of ten, you know, 9.8 times out of ten, it's a liberal professor. So you don't have to, it depends on what the subject matter is too, as you know. If you're sure. taking physics class or something or mathematics, that really doesn't come into play as much. But if you're talking about something like, you know, if you're talking about intellectual history, for example, it's a major consideration what your political proclivities are. That's a, you know, that could really impact what you're going to, the readings you're going to teach and how you're going to approach them. Mm-hmm. What your footnotes to those readings and so forth are going to be too in your lectures and discussions. So yeah, it can, as you know, figure centrally. So.
Absolutely. Well, what's the best way everybody can follow you and help to spread the word on your unfortunate situation?
Memoryholeblog.org and also TracyLegalDefense.org. That's the legal defense fund that we set up to help fund the case. So there's information at both of those sites. And I've producing videos. It's kind of a different. I'm used to doing essays, you know, blog posts, but the blog has become more of a VLOG, a blog. And I've, you know, do 6, 8, 10 minute videos and try to get them done. Now, once a week or once every couple of weeks, and you can find out more about that or look at those videos at memoryholeblog.org. It's interesting. It's a different sort of dynamic, you know, than doing an essay. It's something that I'm getting the hang of now, you know, as far as putting those things together. So it's fun.
Well, that sounds great. If anybody missed any of that information, fear not. You can go to anomicage.com, and I'll have the links for all of Dr. Tracy's websites, the Legal Defense Fund, and the Memory Hole blog, as well as today's video and audio. So please check out AnomicAge.com to find all that and much more if you've not already done so. As I always say, you can't do everything, but you can certainly do something. So please try to get out there. And much like Dr. Tracy and all of our other guests, make that difference. Do that little bit to change things. Till next time, be safe out there, and I will be seeing you sooner than later in the Anomic Age.
Thank you for listening to the Anomic Age, a John Age project. For past shows, further info, and to comment, go to AnomicAge.com. That's AnomicAge.com. Till next time, thank you for listening to the Anomic Age. I'm not going to be able to do that.